This is a podcast from Consilio. We bring people together to create better places.
Hello and welcome to Better Places, the podcast where we talk about planning, politics and development across the capital. I'm Nathan Parsad-Wyatt.
And I'm Luke Francis.
And we're back.
We're sort of back. You're back. I'm in Wales.
Yes. Yeah, we're recording this one remotely, actually, because Luke is in Wales, not on holiday.
No, not permanently.
He does find himself in Wales at the moment. Yeah. So what's happened? What have we got today? Well, we are going to have an interview with Councillor Jem Kamali, lead member for Planning, Place and Environment at RBKC, which was a really interesting chat, actually. But I should say that we recorded it last month, just before the new local plan review in RBKC has kind of been released for the final round of consultation. So some of what he's saying were spoilers at the time, but are actually now very much out there. But hopefully, yeah, it was an interesting chat. So hopefully there's a few bits and pieces to be gleaned from that.
Didn't we have a different Prime Minister then as well?
We did have a different Prime Minister then. And who knows?
I wonder who the Prime Minister will be for our next episode.
Well, exactly. Who knows? No, actually, I mean, it does feel like politics has become a little bit boring again, which is quite nice. There isn't constitutional crisis on a daily basis or changing of the head of state or markets in complete turmoil. So although it is a bit doom and gloomy every time Jeremy Hunt sort of stands up, it does feel a bit more boring. I don't know. What do you think, Luke?
Yeah, I mean, I think boring is probably good, isn't it? I can't remember the last time politics felt boring and not in a good way. A period of stability wouldn't be a terrible thing, although elections on the horizon, people starting thinking about 2024, all change, hopefully.
Well, yeah. I mean, it looks like the polls are to be believed, and to be fair, they haven't changed massively since Rishi took over as Prime Minister. Labour have a pretty significant lead, somewhere between 20 and 25 points based on an aggregate of all the polls. So it does feel like we're heading for Sir Keir Prime Minister.
So I think I'm right in saying Labour needs something like a 12 or a 14 point lead to win a majority. I think that's right.
Yeah, I think that was it, wasn't it? Because it seemed like the swing was so high that would be required a couple of years ago. And yeah, actually, here we are. But what I would say is that, you know, it does show you just how volatile the whole system can be at the moment. And
how quickly things change.
Well, exactly. I mean, it was interesting talking to a couple of Conservative MPs last week. And they was, you know, everyone's looking at these polls and thinking, oh, you know, dusting off their CVs, basically, and looking for new jobs. But one thing they did say gave them a bit of hope was when you look at the kind of Rishi versus Keir, who would you prefer to be Prime Minister rating, there is still a bit of a lead for Rishi, but it doesn't seem to have translated into anything for the wider Conservative Party. So, and actually, you know, I think people are going to be struggling over the next year with the general economic situation, which is obviously never good for an incumbent government. So it does feel like there's definitely an opportunity for Labour. And, you know, with it will be a reasonable amount of change, I guess. And so we were talking about this earlier, weren't we, about the next election and selections across London. So, I mean, parties have started to choose their candidates for different seats. What's the update, Luke?
Yeah, so lots of local government faces who are throwing their hats in the ring, actually, and several who've been guests on the show previously. So Darren Rodwell, the leader of Barking Dagenham, has now been selected as Labour's next candidate for Barking. That was widely expected. He's very popular locally. He's got a very good profile, and it's a very safe Labour seat. So expect to see him in Parliament in 2024, which is exciting. Yeah.
Where else? Labour seat as well. Yeah, exactly. So he will definitely be the Member of Parliament next time.
He will definitely be. And yeah, I look forward to seeing him in the chamber. I think that'll be he'll be an exciting addition to the Labour group in Westminster. Rachel Blake, who has been a councillor in Tower Hamlets since 2014, has been selected to fight Cities of London and Westminster. She was a cabinet member for several years and was previously deputy mayor over in Tower Hamlets as well. So again, a good profile across the capital. And then over in Ilford South, that one's been a little bit of a drama. So for those who don't know, there is a sitting Labour MP, Sam Tarry, who was previously in the shadow cabinet. He was, I think, transport minister, but he was removed from that role after going out and joining a picket line and saying some things about Labour policy that maybe hadn't been fully signed off. But it's a seat that's sort of been dogged with issues over the last couple of years. So there was some controversy around Sam Tarry's selection back in 2019. And Jaz Atwar, who is the leader of Redbridge Council and has been for the last 8 years, Sam Tarry was triggered by local Labour Party members. So a sufficient number voted locally to reopen the selection for who would stand to be Labour's candidate at the next general election. And Jaz Atwar, the leader of the council, won convincingly. So he will be standing as Labour's candidate at the next general election, despite the fact that there is an incumbent Labour MP who quite wanted to carry on doing the job. So lots of drama.
Local Labour members see that as righting a wrong, really, I think, from the selection process that took place at the last election.
So I don't think we have the in-house legal team required to navigate a discussion of that safely.
Definitely not.
But suffice to say that there were certainly controversies around the previous election, and Jaz is, you know, massively popular. He's widely considered to have been a fantastic council leader, huge amount of support locally amongst members, but also very, very popular with voters. So he'll be fighting the Ilford South seat at the next general election. And we've got a couple of other local government figures from around London who are challenging for seats, and those selections are taking place now. So over in Kensington, which will be a really interesting parliamentary seat to watch at the next general election, Mete Caban, who previously a guest on this show, he's a cabinet member over in Hackney, but he is down to the final few in the Kensington selection. So that shortlisting is taking place now, and then local members will vote on who they want to be their candidate. And then up in Uxbridge and South Ruislip, Boris Johnson's seat, among the shortlisted or longlisted, I should say, candidates there is Danny Beals. Again, previously a guest on this show, but the cabinet member for Planning Regeneration in Camden. So lots of local government faces looking to take the next step into Parliament.
Yeah, it's interesting as well, isn't it? Because, all these selections are sort of taking place, but there could be some changes to different boundaries. The boundary review is happening at the moment, so all these seats could actually be fought on slightly different terms. But it's clear again, you know, Labour obviously want to get ahead, plan, get the candidates' names out there, build name recognition and campaigns on the ground as to capitalise on that kind of national popularity at a local level. So, yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see, because, of course, that means we'll end up having a whole fleet of new local government candidates, which of course will be, you know, coming in the coming weeks and months as the parliamentary campaigns really get going. So what else has been happening in the news?
So there is a pop quiz for you. We'll test your London borough knowledge. There is one London borough over the last 12 months that have seen double-digit house price growth. Every other London borough has seen single-digit or flatlining, I think. Care to hazard a guess?
Well, I do read Consilio's daily news updates, which I'm sure many of you get. And I have to say, I know for sure that it is the London Borough of Barking and Dagenham.
Well, if we discussed this before, we could have avoided asking the question. What an anticlimax for people who were hoping. It is indeed, yeah. So, Barking and Dagenham, under the stewardship of the aforementioned Darren Rodwell. Obviously, there's a huge amount going on over there. We've done bits and pieces there before. We worked on the Dagenham Green project with Peabody. That's 3,500 homes. There's obviously a huge amount going on with Barking Riverside over there as well, and with the Elizabeth Line now connecting up Central and East. It's the place to be. I was going to say, so buy there now, but actually buy there 10 years ago, probably.
So interesting what we were talking about with the Kensington selections, because obviously that is the borough that we're very much going to be focusing on today. So as I mentioned at the start, we recorded this just before the latest consultation on the local plan took place, and also, as Luke pointed out, when we had a different Prime Minister. But nonetheless, Jem gives some really good insights into the kinds of developments that he wants to see in RBKC and how to navigate what sometimes can be quite a tricky borough to navigate planning through. So let's get him on the show, shall we?
Sounds good.
Well, we're joined now by Councillor Jem Kamali, Lead Member for Planning, Place and Environment at RBKC. Welcome to the podcast, Jem.
Thank you, Nathan. Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
So you were first elected in 2018, previously Lead Member for Adult Social Care and Health during the pandemic. In May 2018, you retained your ward and have since been appointed Lead Member for Planning, Place and the Environment for a little over 5 months now. How are you finding the role so far?
Really enjoying it, to be honest. It's one of those things that our residents pay a keen interest to. The planning applications, general street scene, environment, collecting the bins, it's something that really affects absolutely everybody in the borough. And we have a very active number of resident associations that pay keen interest to planning applications. So I'm really enjoying it. I think this borough has a really good story to tell on its planning policies and on its environmental credentials.
So when we think about sort of the planning aspect of your portfolio, obviously it's different in every borough in London, and it's often said that London is a collection of villages. What do you think RBKC is doing right, and maybe what it's doing wrong when it comes to sort of planning and placemaking?
Well, certainly on the right side of things, we listen to our residents a lot. You know, we really do want to engage with them on planning applications, on planning development. They have a very deep depth of knowledge. They know the history of a number of sites. We've recently had an issue with South Kensington Tube Station, which is now going to appeal. But, you know, we are on the side of our residents, and so we shape our policies around what they want to see. This applies both for sort of local plans, but also for supplementary planning documents. And really, we take pride in the fact that we consult on everything and that we do listen to residents and take on board the objections that they have with schemes. Invariably, we agree with many of their objections because they know the area, they're trying to preserve the area, enhance it in the same ways that we are. So we're pretty aligned on that. To give an answer to the negatives, I suppose we need to be quicker at getting through planning applications. There are a huge number of planning applications in this borough. It's a very dense borough, and because of that density, even changing your window means that the whole street has to be notified of your planning application, where if you live on a much sparser part of town, there's fewer people to have to make aware of your changes, which means sort of much fewer objections can be raised and such like. So where we need to really work harder is on getting through our planning application. I don't want to say backlog, but planning applications as they come in.
Speed, yeah. I mean, you know, I think that's certainly something that a lot of people listening will recognise, that across pretty much every planning department in the country at the moment, there is often time delays to getting things done, which holds projects up, and be they very small residential projects or larger commercial projects. I mean, in your mind, why do you think it is that that often the pace that applications are determined takes such a long time? Is that a local government resource issue, or is that the process itself? And maybe the government are listening and want to bring forward.
Maybe. I think there's, you know, it is somewhat subjective. What some people will consider a very small minor amendment to a property, others who live right next door will consider it to be really detrimental to their peaceful enjoyment of their own home. So you could say, you know, some things should just be delegated quicker, shorter consultation. But actually, for the people that it affects, they want to have the same length of time to respond to consultations as anybody else. So it's that balance between assessing the application in a timely manner, but still allowing residents the right amount of time to get their feedback in. And we're still somewhat in the paper and pen era where you still affix a notice to a lamppost.
Yeah,
we do email a weekly bulletin, but you have to really want to engage with the system to be aware of planning applications. And perhaps there's a potential way to improve that through digital tools. You know, perhaps, you know, you get an alert on your phone that says there's an application on your street, something like that. But we have to see where the technology will take us on that one.
So this is probably a neat segue into talking a little bit about community engagement. Obviously, you know that that's what we here at Consilio do. We're all about trying to involve people in the planning process ahead of time so that any sort of issues can be resolved as far as possible before the application submitted to the local authority. There's many, many different ways to do that. I mean, RBKC, I think you updated your statement of community involvement a few years ago now to reflect sort of a push for digital. And I know that your predecessor in the role was very keen on using as many tools as possible. What do you think is the role of communities and community engagement, and how best, you know, what's your message to developers and how best they can connect with people ahead of time? What do you want to see?
I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head there. You want to have these discussions before you get to the formal planning application. It's mm-hmm. very hard to change a scheme once they've submitted. It's far easier to have those conversations pre-submission, have a development forum. We recently hosted one for a site in Notting Hill Gate. We're having one on the King's Road at the moment for another site. It works. You know, we can really demonstrate that the developer is keen to bring a scheme forward. Residents, by and large, don't object to schemes in principle. They object to elements of a scheme. And what we want is the developers to take that feedback on board and amend it. And we, as the planning authority, would far rather have an application come forward which has been through all the resident engagement and it has local support or local back-in, rather than have to do all the work with a planning application through pre-app, etc., put it on our planning portal and then have 1,000 objections received for it. Because whilst the committee would still have to make a decision, that means all that work really could have been avoided up front. So I suppose engaging with developers earlier on in the process and sounding out local resident associations, local residents, and even a more wider sort of spectrum through adverts, digital media, that sort of thing, where you can sense check with people whether a scheme should be made out of glass, whether it should be brick, whether it should be, you know, whatever the material is. But you can whittle down your options before you even get to the sort of design stage, which is quite useful.
Earlier and as consultative as possible would be your message on that, I suppose.
Definitely. We want our residents to welcome schemes rather than object to them.
Okay, so thinking about the local plan, obviously consultation was recently, I think, completed on that. What are your priorities for the local plan? Obviously, you were consulting on some specific issues. What does that, you know, what's the purpose for consulting earlier than maybe you need to? And what are you hoping to see included? Any sort of spoilers?
Any spoilers? Well, you'll be aware we're an incredibly dense borough with very limited option for development. So where we do have the few development sites that we have, including two of the opportunity areas, we really want to make sure that they can deliver for the borough, but also deliver what the borough wants to see. So it's not just housing units. It is things like public spaces, parks, public realm, animation. We really aren't fans of buildings which are created only to sit empty. We want them to be lived in. So we're in our draft local plan, we're looking at things like later living, where we know people will then occupy the homes and sort of keep that vibrancy in schemes. Other sort of, I don't want to say spoilers, I think it's sort of good news, is that we're really focusing on sustainability in this local plan. We've We have, again, over 4,000 listed buildings, 75% in conservation areas. We have to move with the times. You know, buildings don't stay as they were in the past. We still have lots of chimneys all over Kensington and Chelsea, but of course, we're not burning wood or coal anymore through them. So what we need to do is think about where the future is heading, be that heat pumps, be it electric heating, all sorts of things, solar panels, and make sure that our policies fit with modern technology, but also fit in a way that respects the fact that these buildings, a huge number of which, are protected and need looking after. So it's getting that balance right, where we can be flexible, adapt to modern technologies, but also retain the beauty and the build and the heritage of Kensington and Chelsea.
So that's how you would hope that this plan is able to kind of balance that need for redevelopment and investment on the one hand, sustainability, you've mentioned the density of the borough, but also preserving that unique character that RBKC has.
Exactly. I mean, it's not through accident that 75% of the borough is in a conservation area. We believe these are areas that need protecting, as do our residents. I live in one of these areas, and you know, you do want to protect them, but you also have to accept that families might want to extend the property. They might want to replace the windows for double glazing. They might want solar panels. Heat pumps are coming. And you've got to think, well, how do we fit all of this in this very dense borough, in a way that residents can support?
And sort of picking up on that point, thinking about things that residents can support, obviously height is something that comes up quite often. And, you know, pretty much every single borough struggles with it on some level. How are you looking to tackle height in you know, terms of density? If you can't move further outwards, very often the only way to actually build a lot of things we need is to go up. How are you tackling the issue of height?
Well, I think this is also a byproduct of the way sites are owned in London. You know, people own individual portions of London rather than rolling fields where they're able to sort of lay out the village of the modern era. What we have is a few sites which are owned by individual entities. And of course, they're looking to maximize the amount of units that they can put on their site, but also, you know, their return for the people that are investing in it. What our responsibility is to really make sure that all development is in keeping with the surrounding area. So we look at heights on a relative context. So a 10-story building next to a 9-story building is very different to a 10-story building next to a 2-story building. Mm-hmm. So we're taking the approach that height is permissible when it is relative to its environment. And in our opportunity areas where we don't have that sort of relative benchmark, I should say, we're sort of making sure that where height is necessary, it should be in order to deliver all of the public good that we want to see. So be that affordable housing, be that public spaces, parks, you know, GP surgeries, all of those good outcomes of development should be part of a scheme. But if they're seeking height simply for height's sake, then we won't be supportive of that.
Understood. And just thinking about that slightly, so, you know, you have that conversation with planners, with officers, in some cases with yourself, to get a scheme to a position where perhaps you can accept that elements of it will have an impact on others, but it delivers a huge number of public goods, it's a very sustainable product, etc. It then goes to planning committee and gets refused at planning committee. What's your relationship with the planning chair? Is it a completely independent body? I mean, certainly from the planning committees I've seen, it feels independent. It feels robustly independent. But how do you sort of manage that interaction between the two sides?
Yes, I mean, of course, the planning committee is completely independent in their decision making. I think where there is some sort of cross-fertilization of ideas is that we are, of course, part of a similar political party, that we have a majority on the planning committee. So we are alive to similar issues, and we all have our own sort of subjective opinion on different schemes, different heights, different, you know, ways of building. But where we all generally agree is on making sure that any development does enhance a local area and isn't a detriment to our residents. So on those principles, we always agree. Of course, on individual applications, we may have a conflicting view. That's fine. That's what happens. That's the reality of the world. But I think by and large, where the council is, what the council is very keen to do is not to bring schemes that put our planning committee into such binary choices. We want to make sure that we've done our job on the policy side to deliver schemes that we think meet policy. Of course, officers make their own recommendations, but if we're bringing forward scheme after scheme that is refused by the planning committee, I think that's a failure on my part to not have those more frank discussions with developers earlier on, and also developers listening to residents, because, you know, invariably the ones which have huge resident objections are ones where perhaps the developers haven't consulted in the same way. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, it's the same issues that resident, our councillors are all residents as well. So if multiple thousands of residents have issues with a site, by and large, councillors in that community will have a similar viewpoint because we live in the same parts of the borough. And that's not to say they don't judge it on policy. It just means that there's that sort of innate understanding that some schemes simply aren't right for this place.
And just going back to the consultation that obviously was completed earlier in the year, I mean, were there any surprises that came out of the responses to that consultation? Anything that I think it's, the world has changed since COVID, and the way we interact with spaces has changed to some extent. Was there any particular surprises that came out during the course of that consultation?
I personally was surprised by the variety of responses that we received. You know, there wasn't a clear direction on every particular policy. There was obviously some things that more people agreed with than others, and you know, we're trying to hear lots of different voices. But I was quite impressed on things that, you know, really are material on, you know, the square meterage at which affordable housing kicks in. For instance, we have a different position from the national 10 unit standard, different from Westminster across the border. We chose to use 650 square meters of net additional floor space. And, you know, we had some people say it should be zero. We had some people that say it should be thousands of square meters. And it's making sure we sort of find the balance in the middle. And we're guided by those different opinions, really. And we had a really good spread from all over the borough with really valuable insights into what affects them in their local communities.
And is there a sort of timeline as to when you're hoping to adopt the new local plan?
There is. We made a very clear public commitment a number of years ago. My predecessor agreed to adopt the local plan within 3 years. We did obviously have COVID in the middle, so there was a slight delay there. But we wanted to work at huge pace on this while still taking the time to consult properly. It will be going for final consultation to the inspectorate at the end of October, and then looking for adoption, depending on sort of council governance, but around sort of early February, that sort of thing.
Great. Thinking about placemaking, you know, we've touched on COVID changing things during the pandemic, and I think RBKC was a pretty clear leader in that post-pandemic placemaking with, you know, the kind of alfresco dining experiences and everything else. I mean, in some parts of London, it has been hard to maintain alfresco. There's been a lot of, you know, sort of objections and some difficult relationships with residents in order to maintain it. But you announced recently that Sloane Square every year for the next decade will have outdoor dining from May to October. Is that working well? Do you want to roll this out across the borough? What might that look like?
So, I mean, my predecessor did a huge amount of work on this, and I agree with you. I think we really did set the standard. I was really recently dismayed to see that Wandsworth had decided to end their alfresco dining on Northcote Road. Westminster, of course, had the issue of Soho. You know, I personally thought Soho is fantastic outdoor dining, but you know, I appreciate it's a different boundary, different ward issues. I mean, for us, what we want to do was strike the right balance. Our roads are very narrow. The national legislation around pavement licenses didn't really apply to us because our pavements are so narrow in any case. So what we did was we sort of explored the limits of the legality of creating pavement at pace, and we found that by demarcating parking bays as pavement, in effect, we would then be able to apply the national legislation to have alfresco dining on those parking spaces. We're really keen to make sure that what we keep, the benefit of that scheme, is bedded into the council's policy so that we're not relying on national legislation one way or the other to continue. We have our own local policy that allows alfresco dining between, well, during British summertime, so sort of March to October. That allows residents living nearby a bit of rest over the Christmas period and in sort of the winter when British weather invariably plays a role in eating and drinking outdoors. But what we wanted to see was that we can bring the sort of the spirit of European alfresco and all the design language to London and keep it for the longer term. So Sloane Square was a really clear example where by giving that 10-year planning permission, the operators that work on top of Sloane Square will be able to invest in good quality street furniture, nice branding, good proper safety measures, so that we can have something that lasts for the long term. Whilst we were very flexible and liberal on the design language over the COVID years with businesses, we did appreciate that a number of residents started to think that, you know, you had 10 different ways of putting up barriers on the same street. It didn't quite blend with the fact that we have very uniform street terraces, you know, beautiful stucco properties, etc. And then you had all these multicolored umbrellas and chairs, etc. on the road. So we're not trying to stop the fun. If anything, we're trying to bed it in for the long term, but in a way that is in keeping with our general street furniture language that we've already got for KNC.
Makes sense. And thinking about housing, so, you know, historically, I think it's safe to say RBKC has struggled to produce affordable housing. And, you know, we've seen rental prices across the piece in London go through the roof and property generally at a very high level. Is this one of your priorities? How do you get more housing, more affordable housing into the borough, so that the next generation of residents can buy houses and live there?
It absolutely is a priority. I mean, my colleague, Kim Taylor-Smith, the deputy leader, is working on our own house building program. So that will be 600 units that we're creating, of which 300 will be for social rent. My role is much more on land we don't own, in effect. So it's working with the developers to make sure that they do bring forward schemes that have affordable housing attached, 35% requirement that we have in our local plan. But it's making sure that they bring forward schemes that residents want as well. So there's this balance between building housing just for the sake of hitting targets, and that could be building a tower of one-bedroom apartments, or building houses for the needs that we have in the borough. So we can see very clearly from our housing waiting list on our social housing side that we have a acute need for 3, 4, and 5 bedroom properties, but of course they only count as one unit in the same way a studio apartment does. So in strict planning policy terms, you're focused on hitting a target, when actually for us in this authority, what we need is to build the homes to fit the need rather than the target. So we're really keen that when developers do bring schemes forward, they're aware of our housing needs and that they are respecting of the demands that we have on our housing waiting list, so that they don't simply try and deliver a certain number of units to say that they've done 35% affordable. They actually build the right numbers of units for the need that we have. That's a very tricky conversation to have. And again, the sort of the public perception of, you know, 34% affordable housing is worse than 35% of affordable housing. But if the 34% is all 5-bedroom units, it's very different to it being lots of 1-bedroom. So we have to get better at sort of explaining the decisions that have gone into bringing a scheme forward and the sort of slight balances we've had to make. As for sort of housing in general as a quantum, yes, we are very keen to deliver some schemes. We don't have a huge number of sites left. Our big ones really are, of course, Kensal and Earl's Court. I think it's sort of inexplicable that Earl's Court has sat empty for so long in an area that has such phenomenal transport links, is just in the centre of London, to be honest. So it's one of those that I'm really keen to address, but that doesn't mean, you know, a blank check to the developer. We have to make sure that they are still delivering the right number of houses, the right type of housing, and all of the public good that comes with that. And on those larger schemes, there is the potential for all of those benefits. There is the space to operate. Where you're talking to a single block of flats, for instance, they don't have the flexibility to build you a park or build you a GP surgery. They are obviously more focused on just unit delivery. And for us, then it's about making sure that the affordable housing mix is part of that unit delivery, and really interrogating viability studies to make sure that in this changing sort of macroeconomic world, we as a council are still getting what we need whilst being conscious of the fact that the figures seem to change every day on the economics.
Of course. Your colleagues across the road in Westminster recently launched a new policy and signed up to a campaign effectively to get dirty money out of borough, and this has particularly come to light after the sort of Russia-Ukraine war. Do RBKC have plans to, you know, sign up to something similar or tackle dirty money that may exist in the borough? You know, huge amounts of cash, potentially empty homes. You know, these.
Yeah, I mean, on paper it sounds fantastic. I don't want to sound skeptical, but I think I'm much keener on action rather than just words. I think where true action will come from will be on sort of government responses. You know, we as a planning authority, as a council, we're not involved in the purchase of property. We don't go through the money laundering checks to see where it's come from. Our responsibility is not to investigate the owner of the property. It's to make sure that if they make changes to their property or if they leave it empty, that's where we can intervene. So on empty properties, we have a 300% council tax charge on empty homes. We've seen in places across the world, in Monaco, etc., where taxes like this invariably mean that people just get somebody to go on the electoral roll or turn the lights on and off. And whilst that sort of sounds slightly facetious, sort of referencing Monaco, I think those houses that we're talking about, the owners of which, that's the sort of world in which they're operating. So if you can afford to keep a home empty in Kensington and Chelsea, it's unlikely to be your only home. Yeah. And what we would much rather see somebody living in that home and contributing to the local economy. And that's why we're quite supportive of things like sort of Airbnb and sort of short-term lets. We'd rather have a bit of activity in line with the sort of the 90-day rule rather than having homes empty entirely. And I don't think necessarily that the powers councils have from national government are sufficient to address that. I think 300% council tax would hurt the average person, but on a very large multi-million pound property, I don't think it would have necessarily the impact we're hoping to see. I don't know quite what the solution would be, but I suspect it's got to come down from national legislation rather than from councils.
So one final message then. Lots of people in planning and property listening to this. What is your one message to those people who are thinking about investing in RBKC?
Well, I think it starts with come and talk to us. Our door is open. Mine certainly is. I think we are open to any sort of idea. We are somewhat unique in the opportunities our borough presents. You know, we have fantastically beautiful buildings, but then we also are very close to sort of shopping districts, entertainment districts, etc. So be it a hotel developer, a residential developer, social community use, you know, or even museums, our door is very much open. And I think I want to make sure that people know that, you know, we start with a really fresh approach to any application. We will tell you if we think it's not going to go anywhere, but we want to try and guide you to an application that will be accepted by our planning committee rather than waste your time, our time and everybody's money on spending, you know, working on projects that don't go anywhere. So the door is open. Come and work with us.
There we go. The door is open. Councillor Kamali, Gemma Kamali, thanks very much for joining us this afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you, Nathan. That's great. Thank you.
Well, that's it from us. Thanks for listening to another episode of Better Places. We'll be back next week as we do this episode a week until Christmas with the Mayor of Croydon, the first Mayor of Croydon, Mayor Jason Perry.
Looking forward to it.
Yeah, it should be good. Anyway, speak to you all soon. Thanks very much.
Thanks for listening.
Bye. 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 Bye.